Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Protect human rights, the dignity of man, and the environment for a future of peace. A preview of Pope Benedict XVI's message for the World Day of Peace celebrated January 1st. And hidden from view for almost 2,000 years, the tomb of the Apostle Paul finally comes to light in the Rome Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Those will be our top stories on today's show. Thanks for joining me. Vatican has given a preview of Pope Benedict XVI's message for the upcoming World Day of Peace, which is celebrated on January 1st each year. The message was released at a press conference in the Vatican on Tuesday. The theme for this January is the human person as the heart of peace. Catherine Smybert tells us more.
In the 14-page document, Pope Benedict makes an urgent appeal to every Christian that they be committed to tireless peacemaking and strenuous defence of the dignity of the human person as well as their inalienable rights. The Holy Father says he's convinced that it's respect for the person which best promotes peace and that in building peace the foundations are laid for an authentic integral humanism. During the launch held at the Vatican Press Office, President of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Cardinal Renato Raphael Martino, explained that by replacing apathy with action, a serene future is prepared for coming generations. The Cardinal explains it was the Pope's observance of this year's situation in the Middle East that especially encouraged some of these key parts of his peace message.
It was really terribly sorry for the fact that in the recent war in Lebanon, the principles and the conventions of humanitarian law were not observed. And so this is the reason that he recommends the observance of the existing humanitarian law and also encourages to develop this humanitarian law taking into account the new situations that we can have from terrorist attacks and the Pope exhorts the international community to do whatever could be done to improve the situation. And so important and urgent problems of mankind are set apart and nobody wants to discuss. And so that is why the Pope encourages to discuss and to take action.
In the message, the Pope decries varying threats to peace, such as hunger, poverty, abuse of women and children, and regimes he says are persecuting Christians or imposing a single religion on their people. The entire second part of the message actually examines what the Pope calls an ecology of peace, where, as Cardinal Martino explains, he notes environmental harm as a menace to a harmonious world.
Pope Benedict tells us that there is an ecology of peace, and this expands. It's important that the human person be in the middle of the creation of the environment and respecting each other and nature. And again, ecology of peace tells us that we have to face all those problems and try to solve them. And this is a goal to help those countries who need help in order to become protagonists of their future. So that we are only stewards of the creation, and we have to pass it on to future generations as better as we can. We hope that this will be an encouragement of Benedict XVI to everybody to study how can they fit in this ecology of peace.
Pope Benedict underlined that states had to set ethical limits to what can be done to protect their people from terrorism, and that some countries have flouted international humanitarian law in recent wars. The message, which is traditionally sent to governments and international organisations, also repeats the Pope's often stated belief that war in God's name is never justified. The Pope will personally deliver the message on January 1, 2007. I'm Catherine Smybert.
Pilgrims coming to Rome can finally catch a glimpse of the tomb of the Apostle Paul after years of careful excavation. The tomb, whose rough-hewn marble sarcophagus dates back to the time of Constantine in the 4th century, was buried in concrete and under tons of rubble beneath the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls, not far west from the Vatican. Though the Vatican has never doubted the location of St. Paul's remains, archaeologists found graffiti engravings indicating that the apostle is indeed buried there. At a press conference in the Vatican, the archpriest of the Basilica of St. Paul's, Cardinal Cordero Lanza di Montezemolo, explained the whole purpose behind the excavation work was to bring the tomb to light so that pilgrims can draw closer to St. Paul.
We knew, we had the certitude that the tomb of St. Paul was there. But it was impossible to be seen by pilgrims. So we decided, we tried to open a window in order to see the side of the sarcophagus. We have been working without making any trouble to all the rest of the archaeology or the architecture, that we could open a window about 70 centimeters wide and about 90 centimeters high, in order to have the possibility for the pilgrims who come to pray to see the side of the stone sarcophagus of St. Paul.
Unlike the tomb of St. Peter, whose discovery was announced in 1950 by Pope Pius XII after lengthy excavations under St. Peter's Basilica, the tomb of St. Paul remained buried from view for 2,000 years. That's why, in the Jubilee year 2000, it was decided that an archaeological investigation of the site would be carried out to determine how pilgrims could actually be able to see Paul's tomb too. Elizabeth Lev is professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus. She explains that pilgrims, at every Jubilee, are invited to pray by the tombs of the two great apostles who lived, died, and were buried here in Rome.
because of the Jubilee year, the point is from the very first Jubilee in 1300 is to pray at the graves of St. Peter and St. Paul. But in 2000, when the faithful came to St. Peter's, there's the excavation under the church, the scavi, there are the bones of St. Peter, here's the confessio, there's the grave. You can see it, you can touch it, you can be very close to it. And then you would go to the church of St. Paul's, and there's an altar, and then there's a Paul's down there somewhere. And the faithful, you know, with these apostles, these two apostles who found the church in Rome, they asked and they wondered and they said, why can't we see this? And looking over the documents, realizing that the faithful had always been able to visit St. Paul in the past, the history of the church, the archpriest started to ask himself, why can't they visit it?
Mm-hmm. And of course, St. Paul's outside the walls is one of the churches where pilgrims would go to pray as part of their pilgrimage on that Jubilee year.
From the very first Jubilee declared by Boniface VIII in 1300, the obligation of the pilgrims coming to Rome for a plenary indulgence was to pray at the Church of St. Peter and before the relics of St. Peter and to pray at the Church of St. Paul. And it has been those two churches, these two apostles, and then the other patriarchal basilicas were added and more churches were added, but the two main foundations, the churches that face each other across the city of Rome, are Peter and Paul's church.
Upon the unveiling of St. Paul's partially excavated tomb, and after a centuries-long tradition, Cardinal Cordero de Montezemolo explained that Pope Benedict XVI decided to change the status of St. Paul's and Rome's other three major basilicas from patriarchal to papal basilicas.
Mentre molti interpretavano che il titolo di patriarcale volesse alludere al fatto che il Papa esercitasse mediante queste un suo titolo di patriarca d'Occidente.
Many understood the title patriarchal to allude to the fact that the Pope was exercising his own title as Patriarch of the West, in contrast to the Patriarchs of the East. This is simply not true, because centuries ago, the Pope gave the four basilicas to the Eastern Catholic Rite Patriarchs as their base in Rome. It was not an official title, so Pope Benedict decided that from now on, the four major basilicas will be called papal basilicas.
Il Papa ha deciso che d'ora in poi le quattro basiliche maggiori si chiamino basiliche papali.
A church and later a series of basilicas were built over the site where Paul was buried after his martyrdom under Imperial Rome. But by the time the current 19th century basilica was reconstructed by Pius IX, after an 1823 fire destroyed much of the structure, almost all sign of the tomb had disappeared. Though the visual signs might have been missing, church records and archaeological findings suggest there was never any doubt that the apostle was buried there.
The tomb of St. Paul is, by tradition, it has always been in the church. But when the great fire in the 19th century destroyed the church completely, the tomb was buried, and when the church was reconstructed, the tomb apparently was lodged and buried underneath the church. But it was directly underneath the main altar of the church. So the excavations just went to dig into the foundations, the area that was englobed after the fire and then built up in the new church. And there they found the back slab of a piece of marble, and the piece of marble reads San Paolo Apostolo, and on the other side of the slab of marble they found a sarcophagus, which is the sarcophagus of St. Paul. The archaeologist who has been directing this excavation, Giorgio Filippi, announced in a press conference of 2005 and 2006 that the tomb was definitely there, but the problem of accessing the tomb, opening the tomb, being able to see inside the tomb was one that they were still trying to solve. The idea of introducing a micro camera in there to be able to see if the bones are in there, or the idea of actually opening the whole structure, at the moment, they're still working out how to proceed.
So actually it was physically underneath the altar. Did they have to shift the position of the altar? How did that work?
The confessio in front of the altar was closed down so that they would be able to get around the back of the confessio and to dig out the necessary area. And so it hasn't disturbed the upper part of the church over the past few years of the excavation, but down below there's a whole new construction. And the principal event that has happened now is not so much the finding of the sarcophagus, which they found back in 2005, but it is the ability of the faithful to get to that place. The main problem was that the tomb of St. Paul is so englobed in the confessio area of the basilica, that the dug-out underneath area of the basilica, that the question becomes, how can the faithful access it the same way that they can access the space in St. Peter's?
The sarcophagus measures 1 meter 20 high and about 2.5 meters long. It is located a little less than 1.5 meters beneath the current pavement of the basilica, at a level and at a depth determined to date from the year 390 AD, the time of the Emperor Constantine.
E c'era un altare dedicato a San Timoteo, un martire del IV secolo.
To expose the sarcophagus, archaeologists had to remove an altar dedicated to St. Timothy, a 4th century martyr.
La tomba di San Paolo non è mai stata toccata.
St. Paul's tomb, explains the archpriest of the Pauline Basilica, has never been touched. It was enclosed in concrete and totally hidden from view. Above it, there is a slab of marble, unfortunately broken in pieces, but it bears the carving Paul, Apostle, Martyr.
C'è scritto grafito Paolo, Apostolo, Martire, che dà la sicurezza che quello è la tomba. Si era vicini all'ansa del Tevere e ogni tanto lì succedeva un'inondazione.
As late as the Middle Ages, when the Tiber River overflowed its banks, flooding the city of Rome, Vatican records show that at least one pope rowed in a boat down to the Basilica of St. Paul's to inspect the tomb of the apostle to ensure it was not damaged.
C'era spesso una inondazione.
Repeated flooding of the city from Roman times onwards would also explain why the sarcophagus was so massive and raised on a platform. The Vatican and its archaeologists are exploring ways to excavate the site further and perhaps eventually see what's inside the sarcophagus. So, by now it's clear why the Basilica of St. Paul's bears the name of that apostle. But why is it also called St. Paul's outside the walls? I asked that question of Professor Lev, who tells us more about that period of ancient Rome and also about how Paul came to live and die here.
Because the name of the church comes from the fact that the basilica is built outside of the ancient Roman city walls. In 271, Rome had a series of, today you can still see this intact series of walls, which spans an 11-mile circuit. The Rome of Paul's age in the 60s was an even smaller circuit of walls. And the Church of St. Paul, when it was eventually built by Constantine, was built outside the city walls on the site where St. Paul had been buried, and so it's referred to as the Church of St. Paul outside the walls, whereas there are churches to St. Paul within the city walls.
It's quite symbolic, too, it seems to me, that both St. Peter's and St. Paul's are on the same side of the Tiber River.
In both cases, I think even more interesting is the way they are spread directly opposite from each other. So if the Romans always construct their cities with what they call the Cardo and the Decumanus, these are two main roads, they're the lifeline, and there's this intersection between the two roads. The churches of St. Peter and St. Paul, they make really the Cardo of Rome, the two balances that define and shape the city. And so it is a very interesting aspect of the construction.
Now, why would St. Paul's bones have been buried there? What kind of a life did he have in Rome? He was once a Roman soldier. We know the story, especially from Caravaggio's painting in Santa Maria del Popolo of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, who is blinded by the revelation of God. Tell us more about the life of St. Paul and how he must have lived here in Rome.
Well, St. Paul's conversion was extraordinary in every way. He went from being one of the harshest persecutors of Christians. He was a Jew. He was also a Roman citizen, though, by nature of his birth. He was freeborn as a Roman citizen, which will give him opportunities and possibilities which will not be available to St. Peter, who is not a Roman citizen. And St. Paul started our first mention of Paul is with his earlier name of Saul, persecutor of Christians, eager to go to Damascus to bring other Christians for punishment and persecution. And God's interruption in his life, Christ's revelation to him in Saul, why do you persecute me? Blinded, helped, assisted, reborn, if you will, he becomes Paul, and he travels all over the Mideast. He goes up through the Hellenistic world. He goes to Greece. He goes to Anatolia. He goes from place to place, forming these pockets of Christians, and then he comes to Rome. And he comes to Rome as a prisoner, because when Paul was brought up for trial, when he was condemned, Paul, as a Roman citizen, had the right of appeal directly to the Roman emperor, which is exactly what plays right into the hands of the Christian plan to bring Christianity to Rome. So Paul was brought to Rome. At the time, according to the legends, the Emperor Nero was not overly interested in the problem of the Christians yet. And so Paul lived in a kind of house arrest in rented rooms for about 2 years, during which time he was able to freely communicate, evangelize, preach. Whether or not he took trips from Rome, things start to get shaky. So we know that Paul lived at least 2 years here in Rome, because it's in the Acts of the Apostles. There are a number of different areas in Rome that claim, you know, Paul slept here, but we know he lived in rented lodgings, and that Paul was able to, from Rome, he wrote several of his letters, and of course before he came to Rome, he wrote the longest of his letters, which is the letter to the Romans.
Am I correct in recalling that there is a site in the Roman Forum that used to be a prison, and some of the apostles were held there?
Paul's life here in Rome, gradually the net grew closer as Nero's madness grew deeper. The catalyst, according to tradition, was the Great Fire of Rome. And tradition has it that,
which was in the, what,
64 A.D., mm-hmm, there was the Great Fire of Rome, which knocked out 10 of the 14 quarters of the city. The rumors that flew at the time were that Nero himself had set the fire because he wanted to build in the area. But Nero turned around and blamed the Christians for the fire. And this is documented. Tacitus tells us that that Nero claimed the fire was set by these pernicious Christians, this Jewish cult that followed a man named Crestus. So we see that the Christians are really they're in line for the first major persecution in Rome. Now, the tradition is that St. Peter and St. Paul were both in Rome in 64. As a matter of fact, we think that Paul came to Rome somewhere 60, 62, and that Peter had already been in Rome for many years after he left Antioch. And so that Peter and Paul were rounded up in the repercussions for the fire, and they were put in prison together, in the political prison right off the Forum, known as the Mamertine Prison. Whether or not that is true or can be archaeologically supported is a whole different question. But what is very, very beautiful, and one of the most lovely things, I think you know this because you and I have both lived in Rome for quite a long time, is June 29th, which celebrates the day that the two apostles were taken from their prison. So many paintings of the two embracing for one last time, and Peter marched in the direction that would later become St. Peter's, and St. Paul marched over towards the sea, and he would be executed at the site of the Tre Fontane, which still has a monastery and church on it. And
the Three Fountains.
The Three Fountains.
Why is it called the Three Fountains?
It's a legend. These wonderful legends around the deaths of the apostles, particularly Paul, has a series of magnificent legends surrounding his death. That the head of Paul was beheaded. It's his right as a Roman citizen as well, to a swift death, as opposed to Peter, who was going to be crucified. And that Paul was led out. He was bent down, he was beheaded, and his head, when severed, bounced three times. In each place his head bounced, a fountain sprung up. And so this is the site of the Three Fountains.
Which is an actual church now. There,
which is today an actual church on the Laurentina with three fountains, which have mosaic flooring from an earlier period than when Paul died. But it's still a beautiful place to go and a wonderful place to remember the witness of Paul. And then the body of Paul was taken a few kilometers down, a little ways down, to where the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls is today. Although a section of the skull was removed at some point, again, in the very early era of the relics, you know that the bodies of the apostles were moved around a bit because of persecutions, because of later date, because of other problems. So, for example, in the catacombs of St. Sebastian, there's the room of the apostles where Peter and Paul were allegedly kept together. Their remains were kept together in a safer place. And in the Church of St. John Lateran, the huge reliquary over the main altar, the papal altar of St. John Lateran, the reliquary contains a piece of the skull of Peter and a piece of the skull of Paul. But I trust the rest of Paul will be in the sarcophagus. Mm-hmm. You know that the description of the grave of St. Peter comes from a man named Caius, who left us a written description of the grave of St. Peter and says he saw the tombs of St. Peter and St. Paul. And so it's good to know that there is a document. There's a document that dates from about 200 AD, and he was writing a sort of an apologetics, a kind of defensive letter. And in the midst of it, he says, "I can show you the trophies of St. Peter and St. Paul." So we know in 200, before Christianity is legalized, before they're building churches, we already have a document that testifies to veneration of the relics of the martyrs, one out by the Tre Fontane, out by the Ostiense road, and the other one on the Vatican Hill.
And my thanks there to Professor Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus. Also, we heard the Archpriest of the Basilica of St. Paul's, Cardinal Cordero Lanza di Montezemolo. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.